With me today is Tom Dillon, currently Shepherd Emeritus of the Lambs Club, and he joined the Lambs in, Tom joined in 1949. He was Shepherd for quite some time. He knows a lot of the good stories of the old days. He knows a lot of the older members, the stars of the past, and he's going to share some of his recollections of the Lambs with us today. Tom, you joined the Lambs in 1949. Who were some of the members there? Who were you impressed by there when you first joined the Lambs?
I was tremendously impressed immediately by the shepherd, Bert Lytell. And his boy was Walter Crizet.
Yeah.
And Jack Whiting was very active in the club then. But Bert, he was the one that was instrumental in starting this junior Lambs, so-called. And, in those days, when we were offered the opportunity of becoming a Lamb, we jumped at most of us had to go take loans, and it was a $50 annual fee that Bert instituted. And so we immediately joined, and I will say that the reason for it was that the history repeats itself. At that time, they were practically devoid of young membership. That's why Bert was in panic, really thought we should have a young membership.
Like,
so as a result, in 49, I think the first round of membership was 25 people, and then we kept increasing it until, I guess, 51 or 52, we had over 200 junior Lambs. And they kept extending the junior membership fee of $50. So that was my first impression, and of course, if I'd only realized at that time what an important era we were in, we should have tape broadcasting. In those days, you never thought of taping it.
No.
You know, just to go into the club at any given time, you saw the great stars of vaudeville, legitimate theater, radio, and the infancy of television. It was a very exciting era.
Certainly was. Tell us some more, about some of the people in those, of those days. I know Walter Crizet had a
Walter Crizet, shortly after, that was 49, shortly after that, and this was the very early days of television, he became the star of a thing called Treasury Men in Action.
Oh, yeah.
Which ran for, I don't know how many years, quite a few years. And he was wonderful.
Now, in the grill, in the old club, of course, for those of you, the old club is big. The clubhouse is still there on West 44th Street, signed by Stanford White, and in the grill room there, which was all dark wood and red leather and was beautiful, but in the center of the room there was a large round table, the shepherd's table, which generally had the silver punch bowl.
That's right in the center of the table.
Right in the center of the table. Now, who could sit there other than the shepherd?
It was originally designed, he had to be a shepherd or a past shepherd to sit at the table. Later on, and years later, they relaxed that rule. I wouldn't go near the table for years, even though I became active on the board and what have you. Until one day, Conrad Nagel asked me to sit at the table. I said, no, Con, I don't want to. He said, I'm ordering you to sit at the table. And that was the first and only time I ever sat at the shepherd's table.
Yeah, I remember the first time I was invited to sit at the shepherd's table.
It was, as they say today, it was awesome.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. You just didn't sit there. That was, there was a great deal of respect among all the members for the older members, the established actors. And yet, within the club, within the clubhouse, within the house, as we say, they would treat you just like anybody else. There was no big star atmosphere that prevailed in there at all.
Right.
As I recall, nobody talked business. You didn't solicit anyone for a job, even though there were producers and directors and writers.
You weren't allowed to.
And that was just against the...
And you had to be invited by a shepherd or an officer of the club to be to sit there, as I said.
Who are some of the other members? Who was around?
Well,
who hung around?
In those days, there were still enough shepherds living that at any given time you go in, you'd see Bert Lytell, you'd see Walter Crizet, you'd see William Gaxton, and he'd always have his buddy Victor Moore. Moore and Gaxton were famous, so Gaxton and Moore were famous. You'd see Mark Begley, you'd see Frank Thomas, Fred Waring was...
I think Frank Thomas was shepherd when I joined. I joined in the 1960s.
And, of course, later on, Harry Hirschfield.
Yes, I remember.
They had some very prominent people in the theater, entertainment profession as shepherds.
Tell us some, I'd like to hear some stories that some of these other people told about the even earlier days. Things that happened in the bar room, things that happened in the pool room. things that happened in the clubhouse.
Well, my favorite story, among my favorite story that concerned Bert Wheeler, which is probably not what you're asking.
No, that's fine, Bert Wheeler.
Bert Wheeler, I worked with him for 12 years, as you know. And it was a man named Harry Delmar, who used to go to the Poor Man's Flo Zigfa. He had a thing years and years ago called Delmar's Rebels. And it was quite successful, several years on Broadway. And Harry one time came into the club. Bert always stayed there when he was in between pictures. And Bert came down the lobby and he saw Harry and he said, "Gee, you look terrible, what's the matter?" And Harry said, "I'm a little short of change today." He said, "We're in the middle of production." And he said, I don't have any dough." So Bert said, "What do you want?" He said, "I need $500. So Bert reached in his pocket, gave him $500 bills and walked away. So about 3 or 4 days later, Bert came down and Harry's waiting. He said, "I'm waiting to see you, Bert." Bert came home and said, "What do you want?" He said, "I want to give you back the $500. Bert started to cry, real tears. Harry said, "What did I do?" He said, "You're the first one that ever paid me back." So you have to know Bert Wheeler to understand that. Bert would give away his shirt, literally, yeah. He did through the years. So that's my favorite story about Bert Wheeler.
I understand John Barrymore often hung out in the bar in the old days. And
he was always there. Of course, that's before my time.
But yeah, I understand that. But you heard about it. Tell some of the stories that you heard.
Well, the story that's attributed to him was not really done by Barrymore. They tell the Barrymore used to be at the bar all the time. And in those days, they had the glasses piled up in a like a wedge. Mm-hmm. And now I can't think of the man that the true actor that is concerned, but they gave it. It was more logical.
They gave credit to Barrymore. Not, right. Yeah,
and Barrymore came in and he was drunk. So in the process of drinking, he took his cane and he knocked off all the glasses. So he was suspended. He was suspended for something like 6 months. And when he came, the day he came back, the suspension was lifted. Standing at the bar, one of them said, "Geez, John, I haven't seen you around here in a long time. Where you been?" He said, "I was suspended for 6 months." He said, "But doing what?" He said, "But doing this." He knocked them all down again and walked out of the club. Now that's what I say. I can't think of the name of the true actor.
I can't either. I know it was a different actor.
But it sounds good to use Barry Miller's name.
Sounds better to you.
That's right.
Pat O'Brien.
Pat O'Brien, he was suspended for when we decided to bring ladies to the club. And he raised the devil, used unusual language for Pat, and he was suspended. And at the time, he was appearing across the street in a television special. I guess it was the Hudson Theater. And every day, we'd go out and we'd see Pat looking very dejected. Everybody loved Pat O'Brien. So finally, they got together and we had a meeting, an emergency meeting, and said, "You know, he suffered enough in the last couple of days. Let's lift the suspension." So they did, and they crawled Pat across the street and said, "Hey, you back in the club." So he came back to the club and he crawled all the way into the bar.
On his hands and knees.
On his hands and knees, yeah.
I'd like to have seen some of those.
I've got a lot of favorite stories, but I go on and on and on.
Well, you know? Go on and on and on. That's what this is all about.
One of my, because you all know this story, I was doing a summer tour with Ann Corian. The summer tour extended into Off-Broadway. We're at the Hudson Theater. They asked me to sing the national anthem at the Old Americana.
Yeah, the hotel.
And we were in the so-called VIP room before. And all I was going to do was the national anthem, then go back to work. So a priest came in, turned out to be a Monsignor. So we met him in the VIP, and I said, "I haven't seen you around, Monsignor." He said, "Well, I'm the new pastor of St. Malachy's." So I said, "Well, nice to meet you," but kind of separated. And then he came over to me and said, "I hear you're in a show. What show are you in?" I said, "I don't want to tell you." I said, "Might upset you." And he said, "No, what am I showing you?" And I said, "I'm not going to tell you." So he came back and he said, "Hey, I hear you're with Ann Corio." I said, "That's right." He said, "Can you get me a couple of ducats?" So the next day I said, "I want to meet you for lunch." Brought him down to the Lambs and he joined that very day. And he became one of the institute. Everybody loved Monsignor. Everybody loved Monsignor. And that leads to another story. We used to have these functions with, you know, the Lamb Base and the Seidel Nights, which would go on until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And Alice and I developed the habit of taking him back to the rectory at that hour. So one night, he said, "You and Alice go home." He said, "Tom Dunn, who was then a newscaster for WOR, a very prominent newscaster, he said, Tom's going to drive me home." So we left. So the next day, I get a call early in the morning. "Did you hear what happened to Monsignor?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, after you left, you went out the cloakroom open. And his coat was gone. Somebody had worn the cloak by mistake." So Tom said, "Listen, we'll hang around a while, and then I'll take you over to my favorite bar." Monsignor didn't drink, incidentally. "A place called Guff's on 43rd Street." So they went over, and he said, "Somebody will come up, show up with the coat. We'll leave word at the club. We'll bring it over."
Send the coat over to Guff's.
So they waited there until about 4 o'clock in the morning, no coat. So Monsignor said, "Hey, you better go home." He said, I'll hang around. I'll go back to the club." Tom said, "Well, come on home with me." He lived up at Lincoln Center. And so he get to the point, he takes Monsignor home. They tiptoe into the apartment. Tom's wife was sound asleep in the bedroom. And Tom said, "I'll put you up in the sofa here in the living room." He said, "I'm going to get a blanket." So he tiptoes into the bedroom. His wife wakes up. She said, "What's the matter? What's the matter?" He says, "You'll never guess who I have in the living room." And she says, "Oh, Tom, Jesus Christ." He said, "No, but you're very close." So the next day, everybody in the country knew about that story because the Monsignor told it on himself.
Yeah.
So that's one of the incidental stories.
That Monsignor O'Brien.
That's Monsignor O'Brien. It was one of the characters of all time.
Yes, I remember well.
Yeah.
Man.
And they show the ecumenical side of the club, which was something we should be very proud of. We never asked anybody his faith or his ethnic background or anything. And it was brought to a very strong point. On a St. Patrick's evening, we were having a party honoring Bob Strauss, who was the animal in Stalag 17.
Yeah.
He was Jewish, incidentally. We were honoring him on St. Patrick's Day. And I was doing a concert at St. Patrick's on down the island, so I didn't get there till after 11 o'clock. There's 300 people on the second floor. And I get there, and nobody knows about this except the people downstairs. One of the men who lived in the club, an old-time Ford brilliant named Jimmy Clark, had died. Dropped dead. We're all in tucks, all ready to go to the party, and he dropped dead. And they have him hidden on the main floor. And it was, I called everybody. I knew a lot of people, police department. I said, "Please, you've got to help us. We're in a terrible jam. Nobody could do anything." They said, "You have to leave there until he's taken to the floor." So it was an awful situation, but we managed to get away with it. So the next day, he went to the morgue that night. The next day, Charlie Reynolds called me from the morgue, and he said, "I'm down here." And he said, "We don't know what to do with Jimmy," but he said, "I understand the Actors Fund will bury him if you call them," because I was on the board of the Actors Fund at the time. So I called him, and Warren Munsell, who was the executive director, made arrangements that we get Jimmy in a Waterby Cook, I think it was.
Yeah.
Wherever. And then I get thinking, gee, we have to give him some kind of a service. So I said, Jimmy was always with Monsignor, but anyway, I went to the desk and I asked Alan Hale, who's worked for us for years. I asked Catherine, Peggy, all of whom knew Jimmy well. And I said, "Have you any idea what religion he was?" And they said, "I think he was a Catholic." Three of them said, "I think he was a Catholic." So then I called some of his buddies, Austin Mack.
Oh, yeah.
He was the pianist for Joey Lewis. I called Austin. I said, "Listen, you're always at the bar with Jimmy." I said, "What religion was this?" She said, "I think he was a Catholic." Well, I said, "This is ridiculous." So I finally called Monsignor O'Brien at the rectory in St. Malachy's. And I said, "Monsignor, do you know about Jimmy?" And I said, "You were always at the bar with me." He said, "Yeah, he was always telling me that someday he hoped I'd bury him, but not to rush it." So I said, "Well, then, what do you think he was?" "Was he a Catholic?" "No, I assume. I think he was a Catholic." I said, "Everybody thinks he was a Catholic. I got to find out what he was." He said, "What do you want?" I said, "I want to bury him properly." He said, "I'll bury him." I said, "Just on the strength of his saying he hoped you'd bury him?" So he said, "Sure." He said, "I'll call." He used to call the Archbishop Cookie. That was Terence Cardinal
Cook.
Cookie. So he said, "I'll bury him." So we had the most beautiful mass. Jimmy Clark and the Monsignor not only did formally the mass, but he came down and spoke informally about his friendship with Jimmy. So I thought that was the height of the humanism. that's had that.
Absolutely.
Wonderful story. Yeah.
Great story.
Yeah. So, what else?
Well, whatever we could think of. When did you become shepherd? What year was that?
1969. Very sadly, I succeeded Jack Walden, who had died in August.
You were boy at the time, right?
I was boy at the time. We've been elected in May, which was the annual election, and Jack died, I think, in September.
You were shepherd for
17 years.
17 easy, smooth sailing years.
But absolutely. Everything was hunky-dory.
I don't think this is probably not the time or the place to recount how we lost our clubhouse and wound up here at 3 West 51st. But
no, I think the important thing is the club
survived.
And not only survived, it's probably in the best shape it's ever been in its history, believe it or not. The interesting thing is that thanks to you fellows, you brought in a lot of young members who were talented and gave them the opportunity of showcasing. And they don't have the old club to relate to, as we old timers do.
I know. And
so they're on the gravy train, so to speak. They love it. It's a wonderful club.
Right.
And I didn't coin it, but I always felt that the Lambs had a spirit that no other club that I've ever been to with, even a prospect. It's a wonder. I call it the Lamb spirit. Something that's an intangible quality.
I've always had I've had a very strong feeling for it. I think it's, more than the players or the friars. And I love that old saying that, the players are gentlemen trying to be actors, and the friars are actors trying to be gentlemen.
Got it wrong.
Tell it straight.
I think the Lambs are supposed to be actors trying to be gentlemen, the players are gentlemen trying to be actors, and the Friars are trying to be both, and are neither.
Yeah, the Friars are neither trying to be both. That was the punchline. I started that off. Well, I'm glad you were here to strengthen that. I wouldn't want that to go down in the annals.
You know, one of the things, we used to have Lamb base, and they were starting at 11 o'clock at night. And, one time we were honoring Milton Berle, and Jack Berle was a very famous comedian. He did a thing on radio called Baron Munchausen in Cliff Wall, Baron Munchausen and Charlie. And Jack was sitting in the first row. Jack had a reputation for being a little tight-fisted with his money. And Berle made a crack that night. He said, gee, we had a terrible tragedy here at the club this afternoon. Jack Berle left a 10-cent tip and the waiter dropped dead. Well, most people laughed, but Jack didn't.
Jack did not laugh. Yeah.
He never came back to the club, and he was a wonderful, wonderful man. So that was one of the sad instances of the club.
Yeah.
But Uncle
Milty could do things like that.
Uncle Milty joined the club, and I was doing his show, as a matter of fact, and Martin Beckley was the shepherd. So he came in and he said, Marty was working for an agency. He said, Burl would love to be a Lamb, and he was blackboarded years ago, which was a very sad thing that they had in club life, the blackboard.
Yes.
Nobody knew who was doing it. And, anyway, Burl had been blackboarded, so Marty said, would you co-sponsor Burl? So I said, sure. He said, I have to tell you, your buddy, Bert Barr, is going to be upset about it. So Marty, I talked to Bert, and I said, that's not right. So anyway, we put Burl up for membership, and Laura walked out. So I guess he was out for months. We were all upset about it, because Bert was there every day.
Yes,
he was a delightful guy. So we Bert Wheeler, a fellow named Maurice Barrett, who was our rabbi. Remember Maurice Barrett? John Feeney, the Irish tenor.
Yeah.
And a fellow named Howard Jones, who was chairman of the Board of Shape and Beer. We all went over to the store club where Bert Marr hung out with his wife. He was always in the couple. But we went over there, we went at his wife's in the couple with Bert. Nobody else in the place. So we said, you mind leaving if you want to talk to Bert? So we all talked to him like Dutch uncles. This is ridiculous. You love the Lambs, we love you. Burl hasn't been in the club since he joined. So anyway, he came back to the club. So that was another
reason. He had to be persuaded.
He just wanted to be persuaded.
I want to make sure that everybody's in the club. What else? Go on.
What can I tell you? Bert Lahr, they were very superstition for people in Portland, especially the comics. And one day I was sitting in the club. Now, this is personal. I shouldn't really go into this, but I was sitting there having a cup of coffee late afternoon, and Bert said, hey, Tommy, you doing anything tomorrow? And I said, no. He said, they want me to do some kind of a commercial. And he said, I can get you $50 a day. He said, they want somebody to stand by. And he said, I'd like somebody I know. And I said, sure, I'm going. I had to be there at 7 o'clock in the morning, place called FPO. I go over there, and I open the door at 7 a.m., and I hear Bert yelling and screaming with Young and Rubicam executives. And he's saying, you don't know what you're doing. You'll have 100,000 calls. If you put this silly phishing thing in, you're dead wrong. You don't know what you're doing. And he comes over, and he says, I'll be back, Tommy. You stay here. And he slams the door, and out he goes. So about an hour later, he comes back with his own fishing gear. What they didn't know was Bert was an expert fisherman, and especially in regard to lake fishing. And the first thing, this was the potato chip commercial. Remember, you can't eat only one?
You
can't eat just one. And what the first scene was supposed to be a fishing scene on a lake, and they had deep sea equipment. That's what Bert...
That's what he was all upset about.
So the next thing you know, we did the first one. I think we shot two or three that day. And they had to have somebody take the potato chips out of the bag. And Bert's hands looked too old. So Bert said, use Tommy, he's only a kid. So the $50 a day grew a little.
Yeah.
Bert used to say, this is our commercial, Tommy. And he did quite a few of them that year. And he was getting, well, I won't say what he was getting, but making a lot of money.
Yeah.
But he was so superstitious about it. One time he said, Tommy, we're shooting Friday. We're shooting our commercial.
Our.
We always said our commercial. I said, gee, Bert, I'm sorry. I remember it vividly. I said, I'm doing a St. Patrick's concert in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. I said, I can't possibly change. I said, I'll be right back. He goes out to the phone in the lobby of the Lambs, calls Young and Rubicam, said, we can't do our commercial until Monday. He was that superstitious about it.
Yeah, and he had enough clout to...
Oh, absolutely.
Well, it's just about
sure
to get it changed. I remember the Circus Saints and Sinners thing. That was
a problem. Oh, you did some of them.
Yeah,
I did every month. Yeah. That was Les Kramer was...
Kramer would almost...
He was 4 feet 11 and weighed over 300 pounds. Yeah. And he had a brilliant, brilliant mind. He wrote all the scripts. And we met at the Waldorf once a month. And what we honored a man we called the Fall Guy.
Yeah.
And we had some very interesting Fall Guys.
Douglas certainly did.
MacArthur, Harry Truman, and you name it. We ran it every four or five times a year. We go to Washington. Twice a year we go to Baltimore.
And we were going up to Connecticut.
We went up to Connecticut.
Yeah.
You think of the people we took with us. Harry Hirschfield was with us. Harry was a great shepherd. Great shepherd. You know, he was in his 80s, but he had a brilliant mind.
He could sure tell stories.
Oh, could he tell stories? But the funny experience I had with Harry, Ray Heatherton had a sort of a circus Saints and Sinners out in the Roosevelt Field.
Mm-hmm.
He used to do one once a month. And he asked me one time, he said, could you possibly bring Harry Hirschfield? I said, sure. So I picked Harry up. He lived at the Park Mandel on 57th Street. Picked him up about 10 o'clock in the morning. We were just taking off, and he said, who's this baseball star we're honoring today? I said, you're honoring a politician. He said, no, they told me with the priest. I got my whole thing. Harry is a fellow named John Klein who's running for county administrator in Nassau County. I didn't know that. So he takes out an envelope. About an hour trip, and he's riding all the way out there. Changed his whole act, did 45 minutes of stand up regarding John Klein, who we never met. That was the kind of a mind he had.
Brilliant. Well, I did one at the Waldorf for somebody couldn't do it or anything, and they said, Mel Allen was the ball guy. We want you to deliver the, not the lambaste, whatever they called it there, anyway, the little homily about the fall guy, where you kind of said a lot of factual things with a few slams. But I had to go look him up, and I didn't have anybody to tell me much about him. I looked him up in the encyclopedia and whatever reference books I could find to make up some kind of funny things about his.
Felt like Tex O'Rourke had done that the year that I guess Tex had died.
Something happened, yeah.
People didn't realize that the amount of work was necessary to do those.
Well, I did. I found out.
That was an interesting thing. You mentioned Mel Allen. In those days, the good old days of the land, we had quite a contingent of sports celebrities. And we had Red Barber.
Yes.
And Vinny Scully, who joined us as really a kid. He was right out of Fordham when he started with the Brooklyn Dodgers. And we had Mel. And Happy Felt had a thing called the Knothole Gang.
Yeah,
Happy Felt. And they did it at the old Ebbets Field. So Happy would always bring the... Walter Olson was then manager of the club, and he'd bring Walter in, he'd bring George Campanella, Jackie Robinson, and every day you'd come in when they weren't, you know, the night came, they'd be there in the afternoon shooting pool. It was a fascinating era.
Did you ever get to meet, like, Fritzy Lowe and some of the big
people?
Lowe who left us
Fritzy, you know, he met Alan J. Lerner in the club. They became friends, and somebody introduced them there.
It
was interesting because Fritzy had, he was playing piano any place that he could get a job. And he met Flo and they started to work together. You know the story.
The rest is, as they say, history.
And you know what he's done for the foundation. Through the years, they've given us, what is it, 1% of his royalties or 2% of his royalties for Brigadoon.
Yeah, I don't know whether it's one or two, but I know the checks keep coming in from all over the world as they're collected, and the foundation gets big checks from
them. Fritzy, I don't know whether you knew Fritzy, but he was a...
No, I never did have that.
Or a guy that, you know, was so brilliant, but he was naive in so many ways. And we used to have these, well, the blow jinks at that time, usually late at night at the theater. And one night... we used to have a pianist named Eddie Weber, and Eddie must have been sick or working, and he wasn't there, so they asked Fritzy if he played piano, and he wasn't good at winging. So anyway, Pat Harrington, senior, was there, gets up. So Fritzy got away with it. What key, and he got away with this, and Pat finally says, "Take me off," which is an old vaudeville
tune. Yeah.
Fritzy gets up from the piano and walks in. One of my favorite stories, people don't know these people, but Conrad Nagel was a great, great actor. And I used to love to come in the club around 4 o'clock in the afternoon. He would usually come in, and we'd sit around the round table, have coffee, and there was a fellow named Ricardo Cortez, who was a very famous leading man. And he and Conrad had worked at MGM, and both had been leading men for Garber.
Wow.
They used to sit around and tell these glorious stories about
which working with Garbo.
Working with Garbo. And Conrad had this magnificent speaking voice. Just and anyway, he loved Bert Wheeler. And Connie had later years developed an asthma condition. And at that time, Bert wasn't well, and we had him up at the place called Wool Lodges up in Saranac Lake.
Saranac Lake, yeah.
It was primarily built for TV things. Later on, they went to MC, or anyway, Bert used to go up there, and just getting there would help. Just in some inexplainable thing about the air up there that would help people. Whatever, went up there, you just felt as if you were cleansed throughout your whole body. So anyway, Connie, I used to go up to shows with Bert when he was in the hospital, and Connie Nagel loved to go up there, but he would always call and say, "Am I keeping anybody out of the bed? Because I just want to go up and get some of that air." So one time, I was going up to do a show with Bert, and the doctor asked me to come up to this show. His name was Evasion, Dr. Evasion. He was a great research doctor. So he said, "We're having a medical convention," and he said, "If you'd come up there and do the act with Bert," he said, "I'd be very grateful to you." So I said, "Well, I have to get an accompanist." And so I called the guy that was doing my arranging, a fellow named Joe Berman. And Joe was a typical New York piano player, great, great musician. But his idea of a vacation was to go to Max Sazman's Stage Delicatessen and have a pastrami on rye. He was,
that was a vacation.
He always had a big cigar in his mouth. So I called Joe, and he said, "Hello, Wheeler, I'll go up there." And he said, "I have a new station wagon, I'll take you up." So I told Connie we were going up. And he said, "Well, I don't want to impose, I won't come up." But he said, "Give Blue Eyes." He always called Bert Blue Eyes.
Yeah.
He said, give him my best. And he said, when you go up there, go to a bakery. And he told me where this little bakery was. And he said, get rolls. Tell him that I sent you. Get rolls to feed the ducks. So I said, what ducks? Well, right opposite the bakery, a little stream. And he said, you feed the ducks. Get the rolls and feed. So anyway, we went there. We were doing a show like at 8 o'clock in the morning. Merman's there. I said, you got to go over to this bakery. Merman's got the cigar, little bird. So I go over to this bakery and I said, excuse me for imposing, but I said, I'd like to buy some rolls. Conrad Nagel told me you have special rolls to feed the ducks. He said, oh, you don't have to buy them. And he went in and he gave me a huge bag of rolls. So we go across and he said, the stream is right over there. The bird and Joe are standing there. Not a sign of a duck. The stream, the water's coming down. Not a sign of a duck. The bird says, stand by. He says, quack, quack, quack. I never saw so many ducks in my life. Tearing down. And all I could think of was distinguished Conrad Nagel standing there going, there quack, 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 with Wheeler. And Merman, I thought he was going to swallow the cigar. He never saw a duck in his whole life. So that's one of my memorable memories of Bert Wheeler.
Nagel was chairman of the admissions committee for a long time. Scared the hell out of me.
Out of everybody.
Everybody, you know. Why do you want to become a lab?
That was the question. You know, the funniest one, you were probably on the Board of Admission. Toots Shaw, the famous restaurateur, was up for membership. And he was downstairs. He always called you a crumb bun. If you were called a crumb bun, you were in.
Yeah.
So he saw me and said, oh, crumb bun, I'm going to be a blam. And he's making a big noise downstairs until he's called up to the admission. I think you were on the board.
No, I wasn't on the board then. No? Yeah. No.
Well, we had this very distinguished Board of Admissions. And Toots is in there, and all of a sudden he quieted down. And he was making a noise when he first went in, but then got quiet. Finally, Conrad gets, they ask you certain questions.
Yeah.
Conrad gets to the crucial question. Why do you want to become a lamb with this magnificent voice? And Toots turned the worst color of gray I have ever seen in my life. And didn't even remember his own name. Had no idea why we put him in anyway. And another thing, when Toots came in, we had a fellow named Uli Moscone, who was the world's billiard champion. I guess he was pool as well as billiard champion.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And one night we had a pool exhibition honoring Jackie Gleason. And he was going to play Uli Moscone.
Gleason was going to play Uli Moscone.
Now, Gleason was a good
player. Yeah, I know Gleason.
Then, they shot the Hucksters at the Lands. The picture of the Hucksters was well
known. The Hustler.
Hustler. Yeah. That's right. I have the wrong picture. Hustler. Anyway, Gleason was there, making a loud noise. Uli Moscone always dressed. If he didn't have a vest on, it was unusual. Very good-looking little guy with white hair and very quiet. Gleason's making a big noise, and finally, Uli takes the cue stick, and he ran, I don't know enough about pool or billiards, but he ran 200-some balls, and Gleason, of course, made an act of it, leaning on his cue stick and growling and what have you. And finally, Uli flubbed.
One shot.
Just so that Gleason would be able to
get a shot.
And then he ran 50 or 60 balls. He was really good at it.
Yeah.
But that was quite a night.
Did Gleason know who he was playing when he
started? Oh, sure, he knew Willie. Yeah. But that was the gimmick we had in the club, especially with new members.
Yeah.
Willie would be in the afternoon, and as I say, this immaculate appearance, you could never have any idea that
he looked like maybe it was some accountant from a business down the street that happened to be in there. Yeah.
They always say, he's a new member in there, and he had nobody to play pool. So that was the gimmick. You know, they go with the cardiac arrest,
World champion.
So I'm talking too much. You talk.
No. Because my purpose here is to get you to talk.
I've been talking enough.
Any stories that you can dredge up? Well, I think that probably is about enough for this first episode in this soon-to-be video history of anecdotal history of the Lambs Club. I want to thank you for taking time out of your busy day now that you're president of the Actors Fund, Shepherd Emeritus of the Lambs, and I don't know what else you're involved with.
Good
to cats and dogs.
Yes. And you've been a wonderful moderator, Peter Collins.
Well, thank you, Tom Dillon.
Right.
And
always good to see you.
Florian Agnew. May the Lambs flourish.
Amen. Absolutely.